That's right, you know, because I said it before, but it needs to be said again, baby. We were born on Planet Rock, and it was in a city that they call Party Town. And y'all know what the name of the street was? That's right, the name of the street was Bad Street.
From Television City in Hollywood.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The following Rustic Exhibition requires discretionary viewer participation.
Greetings from Allentown is taped in front of a live studio audience.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 108 of Greetings from Allentown. I am your host, Peter Winston. And today, for the very first time, after over 2 years of doing this podcast, I had not done an episode of World Class Championship Wrestling. Well, that ends today, good sir, because somebody dropped it in an iTunes review, which, by the way, I am checking. I have not seen anything yet from somebody leaving a new five-star review for Greetings from Allentown on iTunes, but if you drop something in there, like a, any sort of suggestion, I might be willing to take you up on it. This is World Class Championship Wrestling from October 16th, 1982, and this is very instructive. In a lot of people might ask, especially those of us who grew up in the Northeast or anywhere else where we might not be as familiar with World Class Championship Wrestling, where should I start to watch if to get like the best of the Freebirds and the Von Erichs, so all that inclusive. And I would say this is the episode right here. October 16th, 1982. Mark the date. Your end date, it can vary for many people. A lot of people cut it off at David Von Erich's death in early 1984. I like to extend it out to the middle of 84 to include Kerry's brief NWA world title reign and when the Freebirds just kind of wrap up shop there and head eventually to the WWF for a very unsuccessful run. But before I get any further with that, let me get in my plugs. You can email the show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com, facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. Give me a follow on Twitter, @GFAllentownPod. That is @GFAllentownPod. And you may be listening to the show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed. More on Pro Wrestling Only and all you can find there a little bit later on in the show. Now, for this past weekend, my wife had asked me in advance of it, like, would you like to go somewhere for the weekend? Not on a plane, but somewhere we can drive through. And after batting around a few places in New England, I suggested Newport, Rhode Island, mainly because we hadn't been there. And I know that there's some stuff, but that's really, you know, it's on the ocean and probably not going to be that good at this point in March. So we ended up going to Burlington, Vermont, which is a very nice place with good restaurants, a lot of good beer that you can find all over the city, a very walkable downtown as well, and it's only a three-hour drive from where I am. And walking around the town, it's so peaceful there, and I thought to myself, what kind of tourists actually would come in here? You can fly there from New York City, I know, on JetBlue. You can fly from Kennedy to Burlington, Vermont. I don't know how many people necessarily do. Maybe somebody who's skiing in the area. Although the good ski places in Vermont tend to be a little bit further away from Burlington. And the answer is a lot of tourists that come down are from the province of Quebec. Reason being is you got the value-added tax in Canada, the tax on a good amount to any pieces of clothing you might buy there. A lot of good clothing stores on Church Street and that sort of, you know, promenade that they have in Burlington that's very nice. So a lot of people come down from there, I think. And from other parts of New England. I know that before we went up there, because it is Vermont, we actually agreed, the wife and I, to a moratorium on no talk about the senator from Vermont that is running for president, because I'm not a huge fan of his for various reasons. I'm not going to go too far down that road because, you know, I think I've kind of expressed my political leanings on this, where I kind of hate both political parties. So I don't know, but it's really nice up there. And Lake Champlain is completely frozen over to the point where you'd have groups of people just kind of walking out onto the ice there and just kind of, you know, tooling around, looking around, all that. There was a thing that said that due to a solar storm, Aurora Borealis might be able to be seen from as far south as Massachusetts, actually. So I thought, well, we're in northern Vermont. We're definitely going to have a good chance. No, nothing doing. Even though it was clear skies, I don't know what the hell was going on with that. So I come home, go to work on Monday, but I had something else to look forward to, which was Monday Night Raw, or Raw, as I've been fond of saying in the past, at TD Garden in Boston. I bought these tickets quite some time ago up on Level 9, which is the hockey press box, high above ringside, to the point where the lighting structure was kind of blocking one side of the ring. Not very much of it, but if that certainly didn't bother me. I mean, I'm waiting for WrestleMania to see how bad that's going to be, how much of the ring I'm actually going to be able to see. I am very excited for WrestleMania, having seen Raw this past Monday, although in thinking about it, I kind of wanted to compare it. You know me. I love baseball. So I thought it best on the ride home to compare that particular edition of Raw to something in baseball history. If I could compare this past Monday's Raw to anything in memory from an athletic perspective, it was exactly like Bruce Hurst's performance in Game 7 of the 1986 World Series. It was 5 solid innings, shutout, got through it free and easy, and then you get to the 6th inning, which in this case would be the Baron Corbin segment, gives up 3 runs, and then he gets taken out of the game, and then things sort of fall apart slowly from there. So I feel like that's the most apt comparison. Yeah, you know what? I'm going to let the baseball organ music just keep playing for a little bit while I let you know that coming up at the end of this show, I had a running commentary with Keithy, the voice of Gritty Smallentown, during the Samoa Joe-Kurt Angle match, so I'm just going to tack this on to the end. I hope that the audio is good, or at least good enough. I'll have to go back and check it. I'm sure it was fine. It was certainly better than the stuff that I get out of the car, I would imagine, because it was very quiet up on Level 9. We made it through that whole Baron Corbin segment by just saying Goodfellas lines back and forth to each other. I think it was 6 straight minutes of us just saying, good, good, good. Sobered him up. Sobered him up.
Sobered him up.
Good. Very good. Glad to hear
it. I don't have a clue who's going to be sitting next to me at WrestleMania, but I certainly hope they like Goodfellas, because it's going to help me get through that show, especially if it's under 40 degrees. Although, I don't want to spoil it, because I think it's in the running commentary. So, World Class Championship Wrestling, you've noticed I've been avoiding this, and it does seem weird, because, you know, all the cool kids are checking in on World Class in the podcasting world. I mean, of course, the WorldCast podcast right here on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, Pete, Johnny, and Kelly, who I have various jealousies of enlisting to them, because Pete Schumacher has forgotten more about wrestling than I am likely to ever know. Johnny Sorrow, the funniest man in podcasting, so I'll never be quite at that level. And not only does Kelly know more than me about wrestling, but he also has a Canadian passport, which, you know, given geopolitical events of the last few years, I am kind of jealous of that as well. But World Class, when you take that span of 82 to 89, which when you say World Class Championship Wrestling, I think of it as starting in 82, although they did release that Star Wars Hidden Gem from 1981 on the network, but I just think of it as 82 because that's when the TV starts on the award-winning WWE Network. And in 1989 is when you have the infamous Eric Embry angle fighting General Skandor Akbar and all Tojo Yamamoto and all those guys, ending with tearing down the world-class championship wrestling banner, the merger with the USWA. During that seven-year time frame, definitely that period from when the Freebirds come in to when the Freebirds leave is certainly not only the high point of world-class championship wrestling, it might be the best year to year and a half of any wrestling promotion in the 1980s. Yeah, there might not be the same level of depth below that as, say, there is in the World Wrestling Federation in, you know, the years later in the 80s, 85, 87, all that sort of stuff. But as you watch these, and I've watched a lot of 1982 and 83 World Class on the network, 82 is pretty dull until you get to the Freebirds, and having the WorldCast podcast to kind of help me follow along with it certainly made it a little bit more interesting. But there are comedic elements that you know that I love in watching this, and one of them is named Jay Saldi, who is our color man on this show. I'll save my thoughts for him when I get into the show proper. He's alongside Bill Mercer, a veteran newsman in the Dallas area. Earlier in 1982, you still have the Von Erichs as the dominant good guy force in World Class, but David Von Erich really isn't there for much of the year. We're actually going to see him on this show, but it's mainly Kevin and Kerry carrying the load, and you got Fritz in the mix there for a while. He takes on King Kong Bundy in a retirement match at the Summer Star Wars. They like to call everything Star Wars, which makes it particularly confusing because they would have more than one in any given year. So a lot of it is pretty stale as you go through the year. I mean, I think your number three or four babyface in the whole promotion is Al Madrill, who's a perfectly nice professional wrestler and all, but not particularly dynamic in any way. We actually see him teaming up with Jose Lothario on this show. So when the Freebirds come in to World Class, it was something that, it was a shot of energy in the arm, not drinking multiple energy drinks on one drive. I already cautioned against that, but they set this territory on fire, for lack of a better phrase. The closest comparison I can think of, and especially of stuff that I've covered on Greetings from Allentown, is Hulk Hogan coming into the WWF, not when he shows up in St. Louis for Wrestling at the Chase. I'm talking about when he comes out in Allentown to help Bob Backlund against the Samoans. I didn't cover that. I covered when they teamed up the following week against Fuji and Tiger Chung Lee. But the way the crowd reacted to that, very similar to the Freebird phenomenon coming into World Class, because here it's just Michael Hayes on this show. But they let us know that others are on their way, that being Terry Gordy and Buddy Roberts would come in after Gordy. So Michael Hayes is a babyface, and I think it was very important and smart of them to actually bring them in that way, rather than having, well, we got a three-man faction, we naturally have to put them against the Von Erichs right away. They showed good patience there by waiting for the proper time. And there's nothing like an angle that is executed very well, you know, at the perfect time, the way they did it on Christmas night in 1982, the cage match between Kerry Von Erich and Ric Flair. So I said enough about World Class in late 82 and into 83. It's just great stuff. If you ever need to kill 40 minutes watching the WWE Network, I don't think you can really go wrong picking any episode from starting here and going all the way to the end of 1983. I think there's something in it for everybody. So let's get right into the show, but as always, this being episode 108, I'm going to kick it off with a very personal sports moment from the year 2008.
One ball, two strikes, two outs, ninth inning.
Glasnow strikes
looks out. John Lester's thrown a no-hitter at Fenway. He no-hits the Kansas City Royals.
May 19th, 2008, John Lester no-hits the Kansas City Royals. I happened to be there in an upper bleacher seat, which cost me $12. I still have the ticket stub. So pretty affordable to see a no-hitter. And I don't mean to turn this into John Updike, Hub fans bid kid ado about Ted Williams' last at-bat. Something very embarrassing that gets brought up to me happened during that game. At the time in 2008, I was still kind of obsessed with having burritos from Anna's Taqueria, which is, you know, about a mile or two from Fenway Park. I think down like Coolidge Corner. There are other locations. So anyway, seventh inning, I speak up and say, "Hey, you want to get out of here and go get a burrito?" Not realizing, because I couldn't see the left field scoreboard from how high up in center field we were, I couldn't turn around and see that scoreboard that was directly above us, and I could barely see the ones in the infield that had the little runs, hits, errors. So, and I had kind of lost track of what was going on. So, terrible job by me, but luckily we stuck around, saw the end of the game. I recorded it on my phone, but it was a friggin' flip phone, and it's not like I could save it anywhere. So that is now lost to history. It's kind of an emotional thing for Terry Francona and John Lester, because Lester had been diagnosed with cancer late in the 2006 season, came back for the end of the 07 season, and then has made a crap load of money, justifiably so, for the Chicago Cubs. And speaking of big money, the video for this show actually starts out, because I think it was taken from WWE 24/7. With Michael Hayes hosting, with Kevin Von Erich there as his guest. And for the first 2 or 3 minutes, they engage in what can only be charitably described as a circle jerk about themselves. But you know what? I'm going to allow it on the basis of, yeah, I don't want to see Michael Hayes beating off on TV. But if it means I can watch World Class Championship Wrestling from October of 82 to July of 84, somewhere in that time frame, I guess I'm going to allow it. I guess the end justifies the means or whatever. I don't know. So we go to the arena. Thank God. We got Bill Mercer, a veteran of the Kennedy assassination, as a reporter in Dallas for many, many years. Also a World War II veteran and still alive. Born in February of 1926. So good for Bill Mercer. And Jay Saldi, then Dallas Cowboy, is there as well. I'm sorry, I'm chuckling because I know where we're going with Jay Saldi. And if you watch World Class from the middle of 82 to this fall period, he's not there very much longer after this. Funny thing about him as a football player, no, he was not a star for the Dallas Cowboys, but he did catch Roger Staubach's last touchdown pass back in 1979. He's really more of a special teams guy. So it's not like he was Rob Gronkowski or anything like that. He was, you know, kind of the special teams ace. You'd see him on, you know, kickoff return, kick, all that sort of stuff. So why is he here? Number one, he's a Dallas Cowboy and we're in Dallas. Number two, the NFL was on strike in 1982 in October. So these guys got a lot of time on their hands. And number three, he was hurt anyway. But that strike lasted, I want to say, about 8 or 9 weeks and disrupted the season to the point where it became a 9-week season. And then they had what they called a Super Bowl tournament with a 16-team playoff at the end that Washington ended up beating Miami in Super Bowl 17. Fascinating thing about the 82 season, going back to look at it, which the strike was over players wanting a percentage of revenue, which they wanted at 55%. I don't think they're getting 55% even these days, and it all led to the 87 strike where there were scab players. The Dallas Cowboys that year, again, still a very good team, although it would start to fall off within a year or two. 9-game season, they played 3 games on Monday Night Football. So if you think you see the Patriots or any of these other teams on national TV a lot, 3 times in 9 weeks back then was an awful lot. Saldi got traded to Chicago for the 1983 season because he was a favorite of Mike Ditka, who was on the staff of Tom Landry's in Dallas for many years before he became Da Bears head coach. And Saldi was just a favorite of his, and Ditka, of course, a tight end himself. Now, Saldi, he has a very lush beard in sort of the Michael Gross, you know, the dad from Family Ties, that sort of vein.
"You get the hell out of my house."
That does give Saldy some options after football in case they ever do to Family Ties, where Stephen Keaton jumps out of an airplane. And then Jay Saldy can be kind of the stunt double for that. I don't know. But we got a much better Dallas Cowboy on hand to kick off the show. And it is Harvey Martin, star of the doomsday defense of the Cowboys in the late 70s and into the early 80s. And kind of judging by the reaction of Saldy and Harvey Martin as well, it's not clear that these two guys have ever met. Yeah, they've been teammates on the Cowboys since like 1977 or whatever, but I don't think these guys have ever had a conversation or are friendly at all. But Martin, who was in the WrestleMania II Battle Royal with all the other football players in 86, was the 1977 NFL Defensive Player of the Year. They didn't track sacks back in the day, but there was one year where he may have had about 20 to 22 sacks in a season. Drug issues kind of derailed him by 1983. However, he's a big wrestling fan, and if you got world class circa 82, 83 right in your backyard, you might as well go see it live.
No, I'm not a match. I'm not going to do anything but watch. You know, it's fun. Thanks.
Well, glad to have you down here.
Well, it's okay. You know, this is the big night. Jay's on TV tonight. This is TV Night's Foratorium for World Class Wrestling. And it's fun. I've watched him enough, and I decided to come down and just watch him with him.
Well, I'm glad you came down. You got to sit in with him.
Oh, well, I'll have a good time. I will. We'll have a good time.
Gotta love Harvey just kind of blowing off the invitation. Hey, why don't you join us on commentary? I'm here to have fun. You know, whatever. Interesting fact about Harvey Martin, and I was kind of blown away by this because it's been 53 Super Bowls now. He's the only Super Bowl MVP who is deceased. And I thought, that can't possibly be true. I actually went back and checked this three or four times. Bart Starr is still with us. Len Dawson, Jake Scott, all MVPs from the first 10 Super Bowls, still very much alive. And don't be fooled, Eli Manning still alive. It's just his career that happens to be dead. Now, Jay Saldy is a rather fascinating announcer, and they've gone into him on the WorldCast podcast with some negative reviews on Saldy. I mean, I don't want to say that I'm Mr. Brightside with this sort of thing, but he does seem to have an understanding of some of the concepts of pro wrestling. And he seems like a guy who has read wrestling magazines and knows what's going on around the country in various territories. But sometimes he kind of comes off like that breathless 9-year-old who wants to tell you everything that he's learned from reading off all the wrestling magazines. And I know that because I was that in 1988.
Well, Gary Hart's prized possession now is Checkmate, a great wrestler from Europe, still the European heavyweight champion, teaming up with the protege Kabuki, the Dragon, going against the new Mexican connection, Jose Lothario, and the popular Al Madrill.
Like, that has the feel of something where it was just kind of offhandedly suggested in a Pro Wrestling Illustrated. Hey, wouldn't it be cool if Jose Lothario, you know, with him winding down his career, got together with Al Madrill and they could form a new Mexican connection? But the way he says it kind of sounds all wrong, and so the new Mexican connection, like as if Al Madrill has like a roadside stand in Albuquerque or whatever. By the way, Al Madrill makes a great green chili stew, you know, 2 stars in the Michelin guide from what I'm told. So we go to a promo before the opening match that he is in from David Von Erich, who has some commentary on this bounty that's been going around with Kerry Von Erich now being injured, having his leg hurt. And David has a few things to say towards Ric Flair, the NWA World Champion.
There's no thinking about it. We all have proof. We know what's going on.
You have proof?
We do. We definitely have proof. And later, it'll come out all in the wash. When it's time for the Von Erichs to reveal it, it'll be revealed.
Not ready yet, then.
Not ready yet.
I have this crazy notion in my head that Michael Hayes has come into world class because he's been retained as the attorney for the Von Erichs on this thorny legal issue, but that's just a continuation of last week's greetings from Allentown. And Ric Flair will give his rebuttal a little bit later on. So David Von Erich is taking on Captain Frank Dusick. Not entirely sure what he's the captain of. He's not wearing any sort of boat outfit. Frank, he actually has turned up on Greetings from Allentown before. He had a little announcing part in the UWF 1986 show that I did episode 21. But what's much more interesting about him here is he's got a pretty sweet robe that, for whatever reason, on the back at the bottom has the Pink Panther on it. And I was scratching my head like, why does he have the Pink Panther on there? And then I realized, oh yeah, Frank Dusick is so ahead of his time that you think Brock Lesnar is the first wrestler to have an advertisement on his gear. Oh, no. Clearly, Frank Dusick got together with the people at Owens Corning and has decided to promote insulation, you know, before he does a job in 4 minutes on World Class TV. I mean, it's only good business sense. David Von Erich is standing in the corner signing autographs. That's one of my favorite tropes of wrestling from the 70s and 80s, when you have these TV matches and the kids are up by the ring and the dudes are just signing autographs as everybody is being announced. In thinking about the Von Erichs before all the tragedies would happen, yeah, there was Jack, but that was when he was a kid. I'm talking about the stuff that would happen after this point in time. I think of them as something of a baseball team because that's what I do, quite frankly. And I think of them as various positions on a baseball field. I think Kerry right now, he's getting a big push. He's up there with Flair. But I see him as a left fielder in the mold of Manny Ramirez. Yes, he's uber talented, but you kind of want to hide him out in left field because he has certain foibles that, you know, become apparent after a while. Kevin, I see as more of an infielder. You know, he's very athletic. He can do a lot of things. David, though, I see as the center fielder, the guy who can cover for Kerry's mistakes, get over to those balls in left center field. Sort of the complete package. Because David had the most range. He had gone to Florida early in 82 and had actually worked as a heel down there. And that's something that the Von Erichs did not do in Texas by any stretch of the imagination. So with him being a heel there, that kind of showed that he could be a traveling NWA champion, a archetype that would actually go away within the next couple of years. But as somebody who could be the hero in his home territory and then travel around and be the baddie wherever he would go and then somehow get out of it and retain his title. Back on the subject of Dusick's robe, Mercer kind of comments on it, and Jay says that the robe makes it look like Dusick just got out of a bubble bath in the vein of Mae West. Very timely reference here in 1982, referring to movie stars from the 30s. And every time I hear Mae West now, I think Mae Young, and it's completely screwed up my head, because they are completely different people between, in terms of, like, attractiveness when Mae Young, you know, did her thing in the late 90s and get hand and all that sort of stuff. So David Manning is our referee, even though they did that thing at the top of the show where they announced who the referees were for this week, and he was not in that crew. But he had a bit of a feud with Captain Frank Dusick that had gone through in summer of 82. That was a little bit, provoked some eye rolling for anybody who would watch it. And Manning seems to represent the divide of somebody who watched it back then would have seen him as a hero, especially if they were a kid. But now if you watch it as an adult with the benefit of hindsight, you see him as very annoying. However, I liked David Manning when he was on the old Ric Flair podcast, the Woo Nation one that was on several years ago. He was kind of a good guest. I know he was on there twice. So we get some stalling to start with Dusick and David Von Erich, a takedown by Dusick, and a little bit of arm work and all that. Jay Saldi, he's got to speak up, because Dusick went away for a little while, you know, after the David Manning thing, you know, let that blow over a little bit, at least for a little while. But Jay's got to speak up and tell us where Dusick was.
Good to see Captain Frank back in the area, Bill. He's been over to Japan on a very successful tour with Hulkamania. I'm talking about Hulk Hogan, the man known as Thunderlips. Captain Frank was over there for 3 weeks, had a very successful tour. We're all glad to see him back here in Dallas.
So you're trying to give Frank Dusick some sort of rub by saying, oh, he was in the same place at the same time as Hulk Hogan, even though they have nothing to do with each other. Hulk Hogan not coming to World Class. He's in the AWA for quite a while after this, in between that and Japan. So it's really kind of a weird thing. It's like, oh yeah, I know who Hulk Hogan is, and I'm going to mention his name. It just kind of makes me think Japan sucks. They're like, oh, Frank Dusick had a successful tour of Japan? Well, clearly those guys over there can't be very good at all. That they're just not on the same level if, you know, Frank Dusick is having successful tours. But okay, people have different definitions of success. So I go and I look up Frank Dusick's record in Japan, where he did go during this time. He went to the All Japan and competed in, I guess, a tour was called the Superpower Series 2, is how it's listed on Cage Match. And he had 17 matches there, and his record in those was 2-15. What is Captain Frank, Hugh Jackson or something? Is that the definition of successful 2-15? So Dusick controls for a second, but David fires up with some rights to the gut. An Irish whip and a high knee by Booty David Von Erich. Actually, all the Von Erich boys in Dallas around this time were booty men, so to speak. And that gets a two count, which Jay Saldley calls a slow count. And yeah, it was a little bit slower than the usual David Manning cadence. Get little fisticuffs in the corner, and they don't break clean. So David Manning kind of inserts himself in and shoves Dusick out of there. And then we get a weird bit where Mercer starts talking about the bounty, but then somehow Roddy Piper comes into this.
Well, speaking of that bounty situation, and we're going to talk to Hart about this a little later, but I understand that Hart was in Atlanta trying to collect a bounty on Roddy Piper.
I haven't heard about that bounty pertaining to Roddy Piper. Yeah. From Roddy or for him?
Yeah, for him. For him. Get a bounty on Roddy.
So Mercer's letting Jay know that, yeah, I know some things myself, and I don't have to rely on the magazines. And the reason why Jay doesn't know is because from reading the magazines, if you remember back when, those were always months behind, so you'd find out about stuff like 4 months after it happened. Piper's babyface turn in Georgia was in late August of 82. So here we are mid-September. It's only a month and a half later. The magazines wouldn't have gotten to that at that point. Yes, you heard correctly. Jay Saldy would call him Rodney Piper. It's a weird foible of his that, I don't know, after a while it becomes a little bit charming. Backdrop by David Von Erich gets a two count, but again, a little bit slow by David Manning. And Frank gets a flash abdominal stretch, kind of out of nowhere. It was rather interesting. A hip lock gets David out of it. And in the corner again, Dusick does some shoulder blocks, which I recall listening to the Wrestling Podcast About Nothing and Brian Malone saying that that's the move that guys who don't know what they're doing actually do in the corner. Not to say that Frank Dusick doesn't know what he's doing. It's just that it made me actually think of that. So now David Manning tries to get him out of the corner again, and he shoves David Manning. They exchange words. He takes a swing at the referee, and he misses. So David Manning, being the fair, upstanding official that he is, punches Frank Dusick in the mush, and David gets a small package and a three count that was much quicker than the counts from before. I wouldn't say it was a really fast count, but relative to the way he was, it was certainly inconsistent and kind of would, if to the objective observer, David Manning was kind of annoying here. So let me get this straight. You got David Von Erich, who is one of the top stars here. Granted, he's the son of the owner, but I think he would have been a top star anywhere he went. He can't beat Frank Dusick without David Manning punching him in the face like that, and one right from a referee followed by a small package is enough to end this match. It is a little bit irritating.
Runner at second, two out, and Iwamura grounds one up the middle. Utley, good play, has no play at first, throws home, and out is the call to end the inning. Bartlett kept running as Utley hung on to the baseball instead of throwing to first. Looks to first, fakes to first, comes home.
World f***ing champions!
That play by Utley in Game 5 of the World Series would have sports writers wetting themselves with excitement if Derek Jeter had done it. Gets the ball, looks like it's going up the middle. He doesn't make the throw, so he tricks the Tampa Bay player into making a stupid decision running home, so he just guns him down and he's out by 25 feet in a tie game in the seventh inning, I might add. The Phillies go on to win that game. They have the parade a couple days later, and Chase Utley, makes the profane remark there. Second greatest profane remark at the very best at a championship parade behind Larry Bird at the 81 Celtics parade. Seeing a sign in the crowd that says, "Moses eats shit," referring to Moses Malone of the Houston Rockets, Larry says, "Moses does eat shit." And it's also refreshing to back to Utley that Chase Utley doing things on the field that's not basically an assassination of a Mets middle infielder. So we go to our next match, which finally we get to see the new Mexican connection, or the New Mexican connection, as Jay Saldy would have it. Al Two-Star Madrell and Jose Lothario taking on the Magic Dragon and Checkmate. So if I don't know if there's a more 1982 world class match than this one. Although Lothario was only there occasionally, he would kind of pop in from time to time, you know, helping the other baby faces. But Al was a favorite. You know, as you can kind of tell by the way I've talked about him, he was a favorite in 82, particularly of Kelly Nelson. I think Al Madrill helped Kelly get through the 82 world class watching, because you got to latch on to something when things got a little bit boring. Al, at one point in one of the interviews, revealed that he was a huge Elvis fan, which I kind of like that. You don't really hear as much, like, at least on screen, yeah, you get a lot of the back, you know, behind-the-scenes stuff about guys. It's not like, oh, yeah, we know that Finn Balor is a big fan of Ambrosia. I mean, like, I'd love to know stuff like this. Now, on the other side, we got the Magic Dragon, who is Kazuharu Sonoda. Now, I probably pronounced that wrong. But one very interesting thing about him, no, he is no relation to Puff the Magic Dragon. He trained Kenta Kobashi prior to Kobashi's debut. Unfortunately, Sonata, he did not quite make it because he passed away in 1987. He got married first, and he and his wife were going on a honeymoon to South Africa. He, along with everybody else on board, perished in the crash of South African Airways Flight 295 off the coast of Mauritius in East Africa. Apparently, there was a fire in the cargo hold. The cause was not entirely determined. This is one of those weird things that I read about quite a lot, is plane crashes and their causes. And there was a very lengthy investigation on this one that never really definitively determined the cause of the accident, which is always like the worst possible scenario. His teammate, Checkmate, in this one is Tony Charles, who hails from Wales. Hey, that rhymes. And his career was made in the late 60s and into the 70s. He's winding down at this point, and he is under a mask, a white mask, of course, because that's what guys wear in world-class championship wrestling, as we'll learn coming up. He passed away in 2015. Here, the Checkmate is billed from the Isle of Man, which is a country that I always wait for in the opening ceremony of every Summer Olympics, because, I don't know, it's just kind of a cool, quirky name to have, like, to have the Isle of Man. It is between Ireland and basically the British Isles. They are accompanied by Armand Hussein of H&H Enterprises. Now, he's one H of that. The other H, Gary Hart, he doesn't happen to be here today, which is unfortunate because that's the good half. But every time I see H&H, I don't think, oh, Armand Hussein isn't a very good manager. I just immediately think of the bagel place from Seinfeld.
Zach Festivus. Hey, no bagel, no bagel, no bagel, no bagel, no bagel. Hey, no bagel, no bagel, no bagel, no bagel.
For those of you who will be in Manhattan for Mania Weekend, there are two actual locations of H&H Bagels. One up on the Upper West Side, 85th and Columbus, or there is one on the Upper East Side on 2nd Avenue between 80th and 81st Street. Just thought you should know that. So we start with Magic Dragon and Al, and they're kind of stalling as Jay and Bill talk about Kerry's injury as Al gets the better of an exchange. Jay, getting back to talking about the actual guys in the ring, Saldi says that Checkmate has the most moves, which got me thinking about chess in general. And there's a saying that there is an infinite number of moves in chess. Like every single chess games are like snowflakes. They're all different in some way. I was never a good chess player, so it's not something I could ever develop my skills in high school, because if I had played with some of the dudes at my high school, I just would have been a mere enhancement talent. And yeah, maybe I would have gotten better as time went along, but I quite frankly, I had other interests. The Checkmate eventually does get in. He looks very old, and I think that having the white gear and the white mask isn't exactly helping him. Sort of like my critique of Mr. Wrestling 2. I think the difference, though, is that Wrestling 2 was kind of grandfathered in, no pun intended, because of all of his history dating back a number of years. He does look like a guy Checkmate Tony Charles, a guy who peaked in 1972.
He takes advantage of every inch of height he has and every pound that he has, using the other man's body weight to his advantage, using leverage and momentum to take advantage in his situation.
Thanks, Jay, even though you still kind of sound like the breathless nine-year-old. So Jose Lothario gets in there, and Bill Mercer calls him, quote, a young man, the young man from Monterrey, Mexico. Just for your information, Lothario would turn 48 in December of 1982, so he's nearing 50 pretty rapidly, and he's working Checkmate's leg in kind of a shitty toe hold is what he's got on there, and just some mat work to kill the time, so you kind of see where this might be heading, as they cut to Bugsy McGraw in the crowd, the man-child per Bill Mercer, hugging children, clowning around, a little bit of the John Wayne Gacy vibe that you get from those still photos whenever you see a documentary on him. Bugsy had been part of H&H and then was set against them after a certain point. I don't remember exactly how the turn happened, but he became something of a hero after that, you know, from breaking away from the group. And he's out there, like, you know, hugging children. And I'd like to say, we didn't know any better in 1982 as a society. But in thinking of the timeline in my head and milk carton children and stuff like that, it's a little weird that he's getting away with this in the middle of the stranger danger moral panic that we had going on where, like, oh, children are disappearing left and right because you have these high-profile cases. So basically, all of society changed based on a couple of things, and then you just get helicopter parenting after a certain point. I'm glad that I kind of grew up in a generation where it hadn't fully, you know, come in yet, where you could go to the playground with your friends and it wasn't like, oh yeah, you're definitely going to be abducted by Bugsy McGraw and taken to, you know, the Sportatorium in Dallas or whatever. That's not how things worked back then. So we get tag outs, Dragon and Al are in. Dragon controls a little bit, works the left arm. This is very slow going. Again, this has more than just a little bit of a whiff of a draw, so maybe I should hang out an air freshener or whatever. Al is in a hammerlock, and a rather humorous counter to it where he runs into a circle and the Magic Dragon just sort of falls out of the ring. Once he gets back in, there is a chop exchange and a shoulder block off an Irish whip by Al Madrill, which is followed by the Magic Dragon responding in kind, getting in the better of a shoulder block. And then they do another shoulder block, thinking, all right, best two out of three, and they hit each other, and it's basically a tie, 1-1-1, as they cut to Bugsy McGraw again. And they both tag out, so kind of a hot tag for Al to Jose Lothario, who is a bit of a house of fire. Backdrop as Checkmate kind of lands on his feet and on his knees. I don't know if he was trying to land on his feet and just didn't or whatever. And it's fascinating because we get a cut to the crowd, which, yeah, you see that all the time on WWE programming these days. They did it a lot on these world-class shows back in the day where they would just cut to very excited people in the crowd. In this case, it's a woman wearing a button-down flannel shirt, which is something that I always endorse personally. Checkmate now controls, and he's a man who can speak six different languages, apparently. Now, I don't know if Carney is one of them or if they split out British English and U.S. English like you can in a GPS where the woman talks back to you, where you can choose the different accents. Finally, we do get an explanation from Jay Saldi in his infinite wisdom of why Bugsy McGraw is there.
I wonder if Bugsy's checking out the Checkmate for future references.
Well, apparently Jay didn't want to use the word scouting because that's too much of a football word. This isn't exactly the best of any of these four guys in this match, as Jose gets a backbreaker for two. And finally, him and Al get a bit of double team on Checkmate in the corner, and I'm thinking, all right, well, this is going to lead to some sort of finish, as the Magic Dragon actually backflips out of the corner once he gets in there, off the top rope, which, seeing a flip like that in 1982 is certainly very interesting. He hits a thrust kick, but then he misses a somersault splash off the top, which, again, something that certainly makes him stand out. But Checkmate gets back in there and scores with a headbutt. I don't know if he had like a loaded mask gimmick or what his deal was, but honestly, as I'm looking at Checkmate in his gear, he's got the white singlet. He doesn't have the white trunks that we'll see a little bit later with other guys. I'm terrified that his balls are just going to come flying out a la Nikita Koloff at Starrcade 86. I'm like holding my breath watching this entire match, praying that this man's balls just don't come out of his, you know, instead he falls out of the ring. So good, and we won't be able to see anything there. As Al now goes at Checkmate and is going for the mask, they cut again to Bugsy, who is very much supporting this. All four in the ring, but not for long. And again, a lot of the close-ups of the crowd just kind of one by one by one. We get the sped-up finish that you usually see in a match that ends in a draw. A backbreaker gets two for Jose. A shoulder block by Al gets two count. And as Madrill gets a sunset flip, they count to one, and then you hear the bell ring as the camera cuts behind the guy vigorously ringing the bell. I don't know. This was, as I said, this was not the best example of the art form by any of these four guys. If I have to give an MVP in the match, I'd probably give it to Magic Dragon just because of his stuff for 1982 looking particularly good, but if you want to see these guys a little bit better, you watch Lothario in the NWA footage, which I don't know where you see it now that the on-demand service has gone away. Thanks a lot, Billy Corgan. Al Madrill, all through 82. He had a very good match with Ric Flair, as you might imagine, on World Class TV earlier in 82. And I'm not sure about Checkmate, where you'd see the best of him. It's probably, like I said, probably somewhere in between 1972 and 1974. I don't know. Consult your local internet. There's many places where you could probably learn more about the Checkmate, and I know one, and that is ProWrestlingOnly.com. And when you're there, you can explore other podcasts, match reviews, features, and retrospectives. Reviews of wrestling books, video games, matches, playlists, wrestler appearances, and non-wrestling TV shows, movies, and more. Join the conversation about Checkmate and much more by signing up at the PWO forums. Online for over a decade, with over 2,000 registered members in an archive of a hell of a lot of threads. Message board is a vibrant community, whether you want to talk about a specific match in the match discussion archive. I don't know if you'd want to talk about this one, per se. Take a deep dive in the Microscope forum or discuss more general topics from wrestling's past and present. Check all of that out and more at ProWrestlingOnly.com.
Here's to Garnett. Garnett inside, backs it in, and a foul. What a play from Kevin Garnett. And the Celtics go up by 20.
Anything's possible.
The 2008 Boston Celtics had a very narrow window of dominance, and they got it done before Garnett's injury the following year. They taught us so much about Ubuntu and that anything is possible. But the one thing I love about Kevin Garnett, and I liked him as a Minnesota Timberwolves, but it's not like you get to see him all that much because he didn't have any semblance of a supporting cast around him except for the one year that he won the MVP. It's that he had kind of like a hockey player mentality in that if a guy would shoot after the whistle or whatever, he would actually stand near the rim and swat the ball away or grab it. Like, no, you're not scoring on me even if it doesn't count. They went 66-16 in 07-08, won the championship, of course. And then the following year, I think they started 27-2. And then Garnett's injury a little bit later in the season. But I don't want to take away from the other thing from the 2008 NBA Finals, which is the Lakers, the biggest bunch of babies ever, completely quitting on that last game. After they blew a 24-point lead in Game 4 at home, they quit in Game 6 with their season on the line on the road. I know it's hard to win on the road in the NBA, but they completely quit and lost by 39. If Kobe quit like that when, say, I don't know, there was criminal charges against him, things would have turned out a lot differently. And yeah, I said it. And then what also gets me is the stupid Laker fans who are like, Kobe is the greatest. And like, the Celtics won all their championships when there was four teams in the league. And I'd be like, oh, you mean the Lakers 16 championships where somehow they're allowed to count five championships that were won in Minneapolis with George Mikan playing against a bunch of guys who looked like Buddy Holly, where there was strict racial quotas across the NBA. Oh, yeah, those should definitely count. Not even in the same city and basically a color barrier in the NBA. I should get off this. Speaking of champions, originally from the state of Minnesota. We have the nature boy, Ric Flair, and this is going to put me back in a good mood in a hurry because he is on an interview set to discuss this bounty on Kerry Von Erich. And immediately the mind goes to compare it to the 1983 bounty that ended up on Ric Flair in Mid-Atlantic from Harley Race, where Dick Slater and Bob Orton went after the bounty, injured Ric Flair. So I guess that kind of falls under what goes around comes around. Now, this is one of those things. They said it's from Kansas City, but we don't know who the person doing the interviewing is. It could be somebody like a Tom Snyder or something like that, or perhaps it's even Bobby Hollander. I mean, we know what Ric Flair is into, so maybe this is a Bobby Hollander film. You can Google that, but do it on incognito view. So Flair, this is his first title reign, the one from 81 to 83 that sometimes gets forgotten because him winning at Starrcade 83 against Harley Race is portrayed as this grand victory passing of the torch, even though Flair had held the title for a year and a half, 2 years previous to this. What makes this reign a little bit different is that he's like the old school NWA champions of the 70s, where he's traveling around to the different territories, taking on their top guy, and then somehow getting out of there with the title through some shenanigans most of the time. I mean, we all know what it's going to be here in the cage with Kerry Von Erich on Christmas night. But as you get into the post-Starrcade 83 Ric Flair title reign, so anything from the second one and after, it becomes more of a Jim Crockett Promotions only sort of thing. Yes, he does travel around to the various territories. Hell, he loses it to Kerry in 84, but it's not quite what it was back in the day. So seeing him here is very interesting because of how young he is, and also For all the talk about how WWF created cartoon characters and gimmicks in the 80s, let's not sleep on the fact that Ric Flair kind of made himself the exact same thing as the decade went along. I mean, you think him, you know, styling and profiling and yelling in Techwood Studio, that's not a cartoon character of some sort? I mean, it pretty much is. Just because he's got Arn Anderson standing behind him doesn't mean, you know, that it's not. But this interview here, this is as different as anything he would become accustomed to with from Ric Flair in those later years, because he is cool, calm, and collected, and God, I love it.
Well, I heard the rumor yesterday that Von Erich had been hurt, that the Great Kabuki, managed by Gary Hart, had caused Von Erich to enter a hospital in Oklahoma, have surgery on a knee. Somebody's going to lay him up for 5 or 6 weeks. And my response to that is, I'm tragic. I'm sorry to hear about it. But I'm an athlete that knows and is aware of the dangers and the risks in professional wrestling. And I say, if you're not tough enough to be in this sport, then stay home.
Oh, good Lord, that is cold-blooded. That's just some outstanding stuff from Rick. But, oh, believe me, that is not the end of it, because the questioner says, you know, there was a bounty on all the Von Erichs, and he really wants Rick to cop to this, but he ain't having none of that.
Well, I don't know who reported that to you, but that's ridiculous. I'm a very wealthy man, and $10,000 wouldn't be anything to me. If I wanted it done, I'd have it done. It'd be done tomorrow, but that's a ridiculous charge. I'm a professional wrestler. I'm the world champion.
Now, Fritz Von Erich,
I don't need to do have anybody do my work for me.
Well, he'll figure out in later title reigns that it's good to have a gang of guys behind you to, you know, help you out when you're in a moment of need. But, you know, you learn lessons after you do something the first time. That's why, you know, we make mistakes and we learn from them. But what Ric Flair has definitely got pegged is he's got some amazing insight into the psyche of Fritz Von Erich.
Well, Fritz Von Erich's a frustrated man. You see, he'd like to see one of his boys be the world champion. Right now, Kerry is the shining star in the family. He'd like to see Kerry Von Erich defeat me and become the world heavyweight champion. And, Fritz, I'm sorry, but that charge of him having proof that I had that done is ridiculous.
You got nothing in court. You don't got the bookkeeper. You got nothing. Nothing. And if you were a man, you would have done it now. You don't got a thing, you punk.
Flair's as cool as a cucumber, and he keeps it together better than Al Capone did in that scene in The Untouchables when he comes down the stairs and he's got Elliot Ness challenging him down there after they shot the little guy with the glasses in the elevator. Sorry, spoiler alert. In fact, I'm pretty sure Bob Mueller investigated Ric Flair on this bounty issue for a couple of years and his findings. They indicted a bunch of other people, but they didn't actually get anything on Flair. But, okay, Rick, are you actually going to face Kerry Von Erich at the end of this when he's healed up?
Well, I'm the world champion, and rest assured it won't be whether or not I will be the world champion in 5 or 6 weeks. And Kerry Von Erich, as great as the people in Texas may think you are, as great as you may think you are, as great as your father may think you are not in the class of Ric Flair. I'm a legend of my own time. 31 years old, filthy rich, custom made, and the greatest wrestler ever. Not of modern times, but of all time. If you want me in the ring, punk, and I'm hoping you'll have an opportunity to see this interview, you get a contract, you get it signed, you give me a little incentive, and I'll be there. Hallelujah.
That is so great. I don't get the alleluia at the end. Maybe Rick was flirting with religious dogma or something and didn't want to do the woo thing. It would have been completely out of character from the rest of the interview. So goddamn amazing. Holy shit. What happened to this assassin who's just like quietly talking? Like, you want to take me? You think you can take me? I'm the world champion. I'm the greatest of all time. By the way, he's 33, not 31. As he said on there, he's shaving years off like he's a Cuban baseball player already. And this, of course, leads to the match on Christmas night in the cage with Kerry. And you have Michael Hayes there as one of the referees along with David Manning. But don't forget, there was a match in August 82 at Star Wars. Best 2 out of 3 falls. Falls. Flair wins the first fall. Kerry wins the second fall. And then Kerry gets DQ'd on the third fall. So Flair ends up retaining the title. But boy, this was some great stuff. I don't know if this is the greatest promo that I've done on Greetings from Allentown, but I absolutely loved it. The more serious characters who are cocky and human, I always react positive to that. I would say for anybody who wants to know how to do an effective promo without relying on the crutch of screaming, yelling, gesticulating, watch this one, because he's like a guest on The Tonight Show, basically doing this promo in a very calm and measured voice. There ain't nothing scripted about it, even if he's probably got it in his head what he's going to say. Alleluia to that.
Spagnuolo has done a brilliant job to this point, 3rd and 20. Brady rolls, heaves, Moss downfield, broken up by Webster. 10 seconds left.
It'd be easy for me to play the David Tyree catch or Plaxico Burress' winning touchdown or any other plays from Super Bowl 42, which admittedly was a disappointment for me as a Patriots fan. I would have liked to have seen them go 19-0. I had kind of a weird feeling after they tried to trademark 19-0 that things might end up backfiring on them. But that game was kind of like this past Super Bowl in that how low scoring it was. 7-3 going into the fourth quarter. I remember talking to my friend after the game after I had downed a bag of Starburst jelly beans and drank 2 growlers of craft beer. And he's like, I don't know, when it was 7-3, I thought about breaking out the porn at that point. I mean, it's kind of dull. That person shall remain nameless. But this kind of goes in the vein of what I've been talking about the last couple of weeks, where plays in a loss that get forgotten. And this is an incomplete pass by Tom Brady that I just played, which sounds insane. But I'm going to tweet out the GIF file of this because it is no lie the greatest incomplete pass in NFL history. Is Brady rolls out to his right, and just to the right of the right hash mark at the 12-yard line, he launches a pass that goes to the outside numbers at the 18-yard line. So if you draw a straight line, that is 70 yards, and you're doing it across the field. So with the hypotenuse, it's probably about 75, 77 yards. And the ball is right there for Randy Moss between two Giants defenders. And I think they had a timeout, and they could have kicked a field goal and tied the game, or Moss could have even broken it for a touchdown. That would have been absolutely incredible. But the problem was Moss was a little too fast to it, and unfortunately could not make the catch. But that would have been the greatest catch and play in NFL history had that been completed. But the throw should be recognized, because that is an incredible throw under the circumstances. And yes, I am praising Tom Brady in a loss, a game that the Patriots lost. I thought about doing something else to represent football this time around, but it probably would have been like that Dolphins game the next year after Brady got hurt, where the Dolphins came into Foxborough and won by 25. That was like, it's like playing a video game where the computer just keeps making plays against you and you want to hit the reset button. I think Bill Simmons calls it the no effing way game, or at least he did back when he actually used to write and work. In the next bout, we have Grand Marcus number 2 taking on the Samoan. Now, I have a sneaking suspicion that Grand Marcus number 2 is actually Grand Marcus number 1, and they're just branding him as number 2 for whatever reason. But he happens to be, they explain, a contractor for H&H on this occasion. So I don't know if this is just a temporary position or if it's temp to perm. Maybe me and him could get together and have a discussion about how the temp to perm process works and, you know, some of the frustrations about it. The Samoan is Samu, who the future head shrinker. And I got to say, the ring announcer here could not give less of a shit about giving him a proper introduction.
Ladies and gentlemen, one fall, 15-minute time limit, first presented by Armand Hussein, Grand Marcus II. H&H and Associates. And his opponent tonight, the Samoan, Brock Ulovich, to officiate.
I can understand skipping over where he's actually from, because he is the Samoan. I think it's fairly obvious, although he could be from Samoa, or he could be from American Samoa. So I guess there's that distinction. But, you know, it's like the Brooklyn Brawler. Yeah, okay, we get it. He's from Brooklyn. We know that already. But could you give a weight? That would have been nice. Grand Marcus number 2, and I'll call him number 2, you know, I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. He's another white mask and white trunks guy. I feel like having multiples of that on this show is a bit much. And the mask is a little bit spooky. It looks like he's just got out of Black September terrorizing the Munich Olympics or whatever. For his part, Jay Saldi, he doesn't really give a rat's ass about either of these guys, and he wants to talk about Michael Hayes coming up.
We get to see Michael Hayes at his best this evening. I'm sure the man will come out ready to fight, wanting to impress the new fans, because he just got to the area a couple weeks ago. We're all anxiously awaiting his arrival.
And with that, Jay Saldi has entered the Angelo Mosca Greetings from Allentown Hall of Fame by inventing the term anxiously, which is a portmanteau of anxiously and actually. So he's so goddamn prolific on commentary. It's just amazing. So they discuss the Samoans' family heritage, of course, Afa and Sika in the WWF. I mean, Jay Saldi, he can't get enough of talking about guys who are not actually in world class and wrestling elsewhere. But they do redirect their conversation, of course, back to the Freebirds, where Bill Mercer reveals that Terry Gordy will be along. And Jay, for his part, he keeps kind of forgetting that Gordy's not in the building on this occasion, that they tape 2 weeks at a time. So it's going to be a little while before he gets to the area.
Terry Gordy, another young fella. He's 21, 6'5", 285. He is a well-proportioned Andre the Giant.
We mentioned earlier at the opening of the show that when one Freebird's here, something else is bound to follow. Now, I didn't want to mention it then, but now that you brought it up, Terry Gordy is right behind Michael Hayes. All they need now is Buddy Roberts to come, and they'll have the Freebird Inc. back in business
We don't look for Buddy Rogers to come back. Michael Hayes and Terry Gordon will be enough.
Did Jay say Buddy Rogers the second time? I swear that he said Buddy Rogers.
We don't look for Buddy Rogers to come back.
Well, I guess technically he's correct because Buddy Rogers never came to World Class, but Buddy Rogers is actually in the WWF, active, doing the Rogers Corner interview segment, and was an active part of the angle turning Jimmy Snuka into a babyface in October of 1982. Don't worry, Saldi's going to find out about that reading Pro Wrestling Illustrated in a couple months. One thing that's actually neat to hear is they're talking about how, come on down to TV night at the Sportatorium. And just think of the person who decided, you know what, I'm going to check out World Class starting tonight with Michael Hayes' debut. And I get this feeling that they're going to stick around, especially since the ticket's only $3, apparently. That's cheap for 1982. Get a slam and a knee lift from Grand Marcus. And Saldi, he's talking about the Samoan and says that he wants to put on weight, which I guess, well, we don't know how much he weighs because he never got announced as anything. I guess it's 260, 265, and he wants to get up over the 300-pound mark. So I guess he's channeling his inner gorilla monsoon. Then he tries to mention the name of a Samoan football player, and I have no idea what the hell he was trying to say. I think it might have been Mosey Tutupu, but I'm not sure. I mean, such complex names were a little bit much for Jay Saldi. Samu actually cartwheels around Marcus and lands a drop kick. And so he's looking like a guy who doesn't necessarily want to gain weight. And a big clothesline by Grand Marcus to answer all that fancy high-flying offense. And then a senton by Grand Marcus. So kind of neat to see that in 1982. Bill Mercer calls that a flying body drop. I mean, that's pretty much anything that's a splash would be a flying body drop. But, you know, you're hitting them with the back or whatever. And that is how Grand Marcus, number two, contractor of H&H Enterprises, picks up the win over the Samoan on this day. And Jay Saldi, being a color man extraordinaire, sums it up better than I could ever hope to do.
Just a lack of inexperience on the Samoan's part.
Don't worry, I'm sure when the Samoan gains more inexperience, he'll be much better off for it.
It's centered. No shot from there. This high one by Chara off the glass. But the Bruins are getting to these loose pucks. Again, Sturm shot. He's in! Sturm! Scores! Oh, baby! What's going on?
God, I love the noise that that crowd makes when Sturm scores the goal. I had to use the CBC audio instead of the local New England Sports Network one because they don't mic the crowd properly. So you don't get the same sort of sound that caused Jack Edwards to say, "This building is vibrating." And a lot of people say, "Oh, this, you know, hockey was reborn in Boston on that night." And yeah, there was a great deal of excitement coming out of that. But let me give you some background on that series. The Bruins had lost to the Canadiens all eight times in the regular season. They lost three out of the first four games in the series. Our arena was probably a third full of, I mean, it was sold out, but a third full with Canadiens fans down from Montreal wearing their red jerseys. The ads on the boards, I would say even a quarter of them were companies in Quebec. There was a Quebec radio station advertising on the boards. Like, that's how kind of down hockey was in Boston at that time. And this started a gradual build that led to the Stanley Cup in 2011. So it's something that I hold dear, even though my friend Merrill was not at that game, even though he attended virtually every game that regular season back in those days, because he went down to Florida to see a Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band show. Unfortunately, a couple of days before, Danny Federici, the organist of the E Street Band, passed away, so they canceled the show in Tampa on that night, on the April 19th of 2008. And so he never got to see the show, and he missed the hockey game. And then the Springsteen show was rescheduled for after he left Florida. And it was one of the best Bruce shows ever. So just a reminder to anybody who is a season ticket holder for any sport, scheduling a vacation for the first round of the playoffs, or really any round of the playoffs, is a risky game. God, I still can't get over the noise that that crowd makes. And even though they lost that series, sometimes you win for losing. I know I've talked about how great plays in games that a team lost, but sometimes when you lose to a team once, the next year you come back and kick their ass in the playoffs, or and then you end up getting better for it. And it, as I said, it started to build to something. Now, speaking of that, we have Michael P.S. Hayes, the first Freebird to show up in World Class Championship Wrestling. And boy, is this exciting, even though he is wearing white trunks, which the third guy on this show doing that. But with Hayes, I'm going to excuse it because I'm going to say that he's actually just foreshadowing the coming of Jimmy Garvin the following year into World Class. That this is such a huge deal. Go back a couple of years. They're feuding with Junkyard Dog in Mid-South Wrestling, selling out all over the place. And then they go to Georgia Championship Wrestling, feuding with Ted DiBiase, Pile Driver on the floor, all that stuff. And somehow they end up as an even bigger deal in World Class Wrestling in Dallas, Texas. And they are babyfaces to start out, which is interesting because you think of it as, oh, well, clearly they're at war with the Von Erichs the entire time. But obviously, starting them out this way adds energy to the whole thing with the way they betray the Von Erichs, because they are portrayed as sort of allies and friends. And Hayes is also a versatile guy, which is why I think it was good that he's the first one to be brought in. You're not going to bring in Buddy Roberts to be the babyface up front. Michael Hayes is so versatile, he could be that babyface or the heel, and we're going to see it at the end of this match when he has to cut a lengthy, almost State of the Union address, where Hayes goes on, and I believe Hayes says more things in the post-match promo than Calvin Coolidge said in 6 years as president. This is not his actual first match. Apparently, per cage match, he had a match the night before against Captain Frank Dusick in the Fort Worth show. So Gordy and Roberts will follow in. They were working in Georgia in 82. And by the way, he's facing Roberto Ernesto, who, but let's not get distracted by who his opponent is, because it really doesn't matter. The other thing with Freebirds, especially Michael Hayes, because he always kind of looks like an old dude. Like, if you were just to take, like, a non-wrestling fan who doesn't know about the Michael Hayes age conundrum, and say, how old is that guy? And you point at Michael Hayes in 1982, he looks like 31, 32 years old. No, he is actually 23 years old. And if you took a guy like Terry Gordy and say, how old do you think he is? I'm like, well, he's probably, you know, without giving away Hayes' age, because you probably guessed that they were fairly similar, he's probably about 30, 35 years old. No, Gordy is 21, although he's a little bit more baby-faced than Hayes. And then when you show Buddy Roberts, you probably say that he's 62 or something like that. So as we lay eyes on Michael P.S. Hayes for the first time in World Class, I'm so anxious to hear the musings of Bill Mercer and Jay Saldi on this man.
I guess, what do you say? He's cool? He's way out, whatever term that would be appropriate. He's in, isn't he?
Yeah, he's very popular wherever he goes. Maybe it's those golden locks or whatever. He's also a good wrestler, and when I see the Freebird here, I think of the wars that he has had with the NWA current champion, Ric Flair.
I so badly want to call BS on Saldi talking about Michael Hayes and Ric Flair interacting before this point, but they actually did cross paths earlier in 82. They had a match in Georgia, and then there was something else in Kansas City as well on the record. The Goldilocks, like Michael Hayes is going to sit down and eat porridge or whatever. But they do tie a thread together of saying that Hayes had befriended David down in Florida, because David was on that sojourn to the Florida territory where he was working as a heel. Bit of a slow start with Hayes and Ernesto. Kind of doing that multiple lockup thing where, like, they lock up and then they kind of stop. A lot of stalling. And then eventually he just chucks Ernesto to the floor off lockup number 4 or 5. I stopped counting after a while. He slingshots Ernesto back into the ring and immediately goes up top and hits a right hand. And then kind of does, I guess, the Michael Hayes version of the Ali shuffle and then hits an elbow. And then he starts high-stepping, but it doesn't quite look as cool as like what you would see Deion Sanders do a decade later. It's kind of like a white guy high-step. And I mean, you know what I'm talking about with the difference of that. Head to the turnbuckle by Renesto as he's trying to fight back. But see, Michael Hayes doesn't sell that because, as he told Mark Henry, Michael Hayes believes he is more black than actual black people, which I'm not going to use the language that Michael Hayes used because, well, you know, he certainly has issues. And he hits the bulldog, which Bill Mercer calls a flying head drop, which I feel like you could call a lot of moves that, and then a different kind of flying head drop. Michael Hayes finishes off Renesto with the pile driver for the 1-2-3, and the crowd is definitely behind him, and we're just building and building until you get to that big bang on Christmas night. So Jay Saldi here, because he just can't help himself talking about stuff in, going on in other territories in 1982. Of course he's going to launch into a mild non sequitur about pile drivers.
I'll tell you what, if you don't know about the pile driver, ask Andy Kaufman. Was put on him by Jerry Lawler. All it did was break his neck, and looks like Renesto is hurting himself.
Once again, this is something that he clearly read in Pro Wrestling Illustrated, because that took place over the summertime, so enough time has passed for him to reference it here in October of 82. He almost feels like a spy, like a double agent for Stu Sachs or whatever, but he's not actually actively plugging the magazine, so that's probably why that didn't take place. He says that Renesto has been put out by the pile driver, which is a funny thing to say, because the dude kind of gets right back up and attacks Michael Hayes and sort of no-sells it, but Hayes with the Irish whip, because that's what you do in a fight. That's how you fight back, is an Irish whip, a backdrop, and then eventually he chases him off. So now we get the Michael Hayes post-match speech to kind of introduce himself and ingratiate himself with the public. He will face Wild Bill Irwin, the former Texas champion, on the next week's show.
That's good. You know, it's good to get down here in Dallas, Texas. I said at the beginning of the year that Freebird Fantasia was going to rock and roll all over this country, and it's about time we got here. Now, I want to make y'all a promise that the next time you see me, it's not going to be the single version. It's going to be the double, because Brother Terry is going to be right beside me.
There you have it.
I ain't quite sure if all of y'all know us, but just to let you know, baby, myself, I have 240 pounds of twisted steel and 6 O'Peel.
So hilarious, that part where Jay Saldi thinks that Michael Hayes is done and starts to talk. Well, there you have it. Reminds me of that old SNL skit where George Bush, 41, is giving the State of the Union, and they got Dan Quayle behind him, and he's determined to be the first guy to his feet for one of the applause lines, and actually screws up and does it at the wrong time. But Hayes, like I said, this ain't no Calvin Coolidge speech. He's going to go on.
And you know what, something, baby? From the day we was born, you know, we was born on the wrong side of the tracks, so they say that's okay. Because when you get something the hard way, then you earn it, and everybody out there knows that. That's right. Is that right? And from the time we were little kids and we used to get thrown in and getting in trouble, well, now we get paid for doing what they got us in trouble for. That's right, you know, because I said it before, but it needs to be said again, baby. We were born on Planet Rock, and it was in a city that they call Party Town. And y'all know what the name of the street was? That's right, the name of the street was Bad Street. And you know the reason they called it Bad Street? Was because the further you went down the block, the better it got.
I'm pretty sure some members of the female audience there in attendance at the Sportatorium, which is certainly rising as we go through 1982, that's something you notice watching the TV, throwing their underwear at Michael Hayes. They managed to edit that out. But boy, this is a big fucking deal, as Joe Biden would say. It's very unusual. It's not like Al Madrill ever got 5 minutes after one of his matches to give a speech about how much, you know, he loves Elvis and how he's a man of the people and all that. So it kind of separates this out and signals to the audience of how important it is. But because this is world class 1982, it's not, I can't just let it stand on its own. I need to know what Dallas Cowboy Jake Saldi thinks.
Well, there you have it. You heard it from the free bird himself that Brother Terry is on his way. And believe it or not, Bill, I feel that their father was a preacher man.
All right, Jay, whatever you say. And then Mercer has to correct Jay again when he says that Gordy's going to be here next week. And Mercer's like, no, no, he's not going to be there that soon because we tape 2 weeks at a time here at the Sportatorium. And did you see Gordy backstage? No. No, you didn't. So he's not going to be here for a couple weeks. Bad. Bad, Saldi. Go to your room. Go to your room. No TV and no Pro Wrestling Illustrated for you. But before they actually 100% wrap up for this show, as I had mentioned, Michael Hayes on the next week's program is going to be taking on Wild Bill Irwin, that awful goon. And he gets to say a few things about what he just saw from the Freebird, as they keep calling Hayes. And I'm kind of shocked because Irwin is such a goon. I was expecting him to say that he's got to give 110% every time out there. He's got to take it one match at a time. And then he's got to put the puck in the net.
Michael Hayes, the Freebird. You know, he gets in here and he flies all around. But there's one thing, Michael Hayes, when you get in the ring with me, you're going to be caged. Just like those hawks that they put on little perches and have strings on and the blinds on. I'm going to have you just like that because you won't know where you're going or when you're going. You'll be in there with me, running you crazy. And then I'm going to put you down for the 1, 2, 3, and you can go cry on your big brother's shoulder.
Well, I'm not sure all of that is going to come to fruition, but if it did come down to it, I do think Terry Gordy has a pretty good set of shoulders to cry on, if it actually came to that. And that is a wrap for World Class Championship Wrestling, October 16th, 1982. Give a get well shout out to my occasional podcast partner Steve Bennett, who'd been feeling a little bit under the weather earlier this week, but on these last sportscasters he had on Jeff Passan to talk 2019 MLB, and also he was on the Richard Deitch podcast on sports media, because Steve had pitched an idea that Richard have on podcasters, some independents, some belonging to big networks. So on that podcast, Steve is there as one of the guests. Greg Wyshynski is there as well from ESPN, and Conrad Thompson as well. And there are a couple of other independent podcasts as well. It was certainly a very interesting listen. On the Our Vantage Point podcast this past week, they talk about Brother Virgil, do Joe Morata and Michael Quinn, the fall of Brother Virgil from mega superstar in 1991 as the number three or four babyface in the entire WWF. Yeah, I might be overstating it, but Virgil was a huge part of our nation's heritage for that 1 year, and it should not be forgotten. And on the Wrestling Podcast About Nothing with Ring of Honor's Brian Malonis and Mike Crockett, they've had a really good run of shows lately, so I urge you to check it out. But this week, Brian and Mike are talking about how Brian has been putting together an independent show, a benefit show up in Derry, New Hampshire, that'll be this Saturday, Astromania. And it was fascinating to hear somebody talk about the mechanics of putting one of these things together in terms of dealing with site costs, getting a ring brought in, and you know, trying to make that work without, you know, bankrupting yourself while doing it. Also stuff about state athletic commissions, things like that that don't exist here in Massachusetts, but New Hampshire is kind of a different animal. So do check that out. I wish I could go to that show, but if I went to two wrestling shows in the same week, it would certainly harm my marriage, especially since I'm going to New Jersey next week for Mania. So maybe while I'm there, maybe I should just try to go to as many wrestling shows while I'm down there so I can just kind of get it all out of my system. But before I go for this week, I want to sneak in a quick edition of YouTube Comment Theater. Yes, there is a version of this episode on YouTube. Shh, don't tell anybody about it. I want it to stay out there as long as possible, especially for the Michael Hayes, Kevin Von Erich circle jerk at the beginning, as I mentioned, and also there's a brief one at the end. As always, these are actual YouTube comments left by actual people, some of whom actually have avatars. We'll start with Butler Hippie, who says, "What's up with Renesto no-selling the pile driver? Not very jobber of him. Actually, he didn't sell throughout the match. Was this guy actually a name around Dallas?" Yeah, he was there for a long time, and also in other places as well. I didn't go into his whole history because I didn't want to distract from the fact that this is Michael Hayes' freaking debut in World Class Championship Wrestling. Haroof says, "LOL, I can't get over how lazy Bronco Lubitsch was in that ring." And yeah, I talked a little bit about David Manning in the opening match and how he had his foibles, but Bronco Lubitsch was this really old guy who had probably been refereeing for many, many years and had just kind of had enough of it. Instead of actually going down anytime he had to count a fall, he would just kind of get to one knee on occasion. Like, I'm surprised he didn't just, like, move his arm like he was counting a guy out in boxing. I feel like that would have been, you know, the next logical step. Brian Washington says, "Nate did as much to make the Von Erichs as the feud with the Freebirds did." I don't know if I would go that far. He had matches with all of them, but it's not quite to the level of the Freebirds and the Von Erichs, which is an every week sort of thing, whereas Flair would kind of float in at various points during the year. Phil Robb says, "Vince bled these territories dry, now he's making money off them." Well, at least WWE fans would now realize how much better the territories were than the WWF was then and the WWE is now. So that's our comment that we always get on this. It's, "Oh, wrestling sucks these days and I hate WWE and or WWF. And I will say this, at least for WWE, is the having that library there and maintaining it the way that they have, at least it provides a platform to see this easily. I think about the network being $9.99 and that I can literally watch world-class shows from anywhere from 82 to 88 at any time that I want. So I'm actually pretty grateful for that. DKG46342 says, "What was Frank Dusik the captain of?" And I have no idea, because it's not like he's doing the Mike Rotunda thing where he's like the captain of a ship. I mean, he could literally be like the captain of a loading dock. I mean, that's really more of a foreman, I think, is the name you would use for that. Harold Keel says, "Nice to see Spicoli from Fast Times doing some announcing here." I think he's referring to Mark Lorenz, the ring announcer, and I didn't really get the vibe that he looks like Spicoli. But by the way, when I drive to work, I drive past a place called Lawrence Street, and every single day it tells me to make a left onto Lorenz Street rather than Lawrence Street. And I think that my GPS in my phone in Google Maps is doing that as a sort of hidden tribute to former world-class announcer Mark Lorenz. Burt Mustin says, "Even the guest athletes making cameo appearances in world-class died too soon. Harvey Martin died of cancer at 51 in 2001. And I cannot get over the fact that he is the only Super Bowl MVP who has actually passed away. It's just crazy. Mike Thaxton said, "In real life, Flair said David was a rising star and there was plans to have him win the NWA world title and go on a long run with it." Well, I don't think that a long run was going to be in the cards for any of the Von Erichs because of the way Fritz was very provincial in Texas. And by that point, Flair was establishing himself as the man who could go around to the various places. Although out of all the Von Erichs, I think David was the best equipped to have that role. It's just that, as I said, later in the 80s, the NWA champion would become a Jim Crockett only thing as he consolidated his power. And finally, Fat Harold says, "It's cool hearing the announcers talking about things going on in other promotions." Yeah, I'm okay with it. It's just that the way Saldi would bring it up, like you said, he's a breathless 9-year-old who wants to tell you about everything he read in the last Pro Wrestling Illustrated, whether it be Hulk Hogan or what the Freebirds were up to previously. There's just so much of it, and you just want to pat him on the head and say, "Okay, kid, okay." And that'll do it for YouTube Comment Theater. As I was planning shows in advance, which I feel like I do better doing that rather than just kind of grabbing one on a Friday and then working on it over the weekend. I knew that next week would be the lead-in to WrestleMania 35 in New Jersey. So I kind of approached it with the question, what was the go-home show for the first WrestleMania like? So in that vein, I'll be taking a look at Championship Wrestling, WWF, from March 30th, 1985, which also happened to be the day that Mr. T and Hulk Hogan hosted Saturday Night Live, which I would love to review that actual Saturday Night Live episode at some point. I feel like that would be a lot of fun, but I don't actually own any of the SNL DVDs, and I don't know, there might be a bit much to it, but there are a couple of newcomers to the WWF on that show, including King Kong Bundy in action, as well as Ricky Steamboat, who has not yet gained his dragon license. And his opponent in that one, well, it's kind of a fun thing, so I'll wait to get to that. And then there is a Hulk Hogan Mr. T video airing to get everybody pumped up for WrestleMania the following day. And there's also an interesting thing that they have to do to alert people about the circumstances surrounding WrestleMania so that there is no confusion. So WWF Championship Wrestling, March 30th, 1985, coming next week. Also, I was on the Place to Be podcast a couple of days ago looking at the Saturday Night's Main Event from March 11th, 1989. This is certainly one of the more fun Saturday Night Main Events that there ever was. I gave it a much higher rating than JT and Scott because it has that great Bad News Brown Hulk Hogan match, which there's a hilarious thing that happens. Actually, there are multiple hilarious things that happen during that bout. The Rockers versus the Brainbusters. I mean, need I say any more than that? And the Red Rooster versus Brooklyn Brawler, yes. That's probably why I had the Brooklyn Brawler on my mind earlier. It's because, like, I've actually had to think about him this week. So don't forget to leave a 5-star review on iTunes, Apple Music, not only for Greetings from Allentown, but for the Pro Wrestling Only feed. I did see a couple of them out there, and there was a request for some Portland wrestling. And I hear you, and I am looking for an episode of a proper episode of Portland wrestling for me to review at some point, because there are a lot of great moments that I've watched on YouTube over the years from Portland. Luke Williams getting his head shaved by Roddy Piper. Just seeing one of the Bushwhackers have hair is just so hilarious. And then the greatest moment, I don't know, maybe it's not the greatest moment, but Buddy Rose's face turn in Portland after being a heel there for so long in 1983 is quite a magical moment, with the fans storming the ring with such great joy. So I'm going to get to one of those at some point in the coming weeks and months. Again, thank you so much for listening. And coming up after the outro here, I'm going to have the running commentary of me and Keithy watching the Kurt Angle versus Samoa Joe match live at Raw this past Monday in Boston. So do tune in next Thursday for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.
All right, here we are at Monday Night Raw in Boston for Kurt Angle's farewell tour.
Yes.
This Slammiversary pay-per-view. I am here along with the voice of Greetings from Allentown, Keith Langston.
Hello!
And you can probably hear him because we're just kind of spitballing here for this Angle.
Yes.
Were you as excited as me when you found out that this match was happening?
I was excited. It's two of the three people that wrestled in Sacrifice. No, we're missing the best part, though. No Steiner Math.
Well,
that's okay.
That is a shame, but maybe if Steiner was here, he could tell us what the hell that is on Samoa Joe's left arm. We get a USA chant, even though Samoa Joe from Huntington Beach, California.
Yes.
A very fine community where I believe a lot of the members of the Los Angeles Kings live. You know, the 31st best team in the National Hockey League. You know what I like most about Samoa Joe, and you might agree with me because you're in the same league as me, is this. He's born the same year as us. And I always have a soft spot for athletes,
absolutely,
whether they're professional wrestlers, hockey players, whatever they are. And Joe's going to do the dive over the top rope onto Kurt Angle.
Oh, okay.
Which...
Not bad.
All right, so Finn Balor, when he does it...
It's very athletic.
It's very athletic.
Graceful.
But when Joe does it, it's like, oh, well, it's a 290-pound...
It's a train wreck.
What's his weight at? I feel like, say, a Gorilla Monsoon, like, oh, he's over the 350-pound mark.
Well, I'd have to say he's about 300... Moving north of 350, 375, Jess, I would have to say.
I always love when Gorilla Monsoon would call bullshit on the weights and would overestimate it by 60 pounds. It's,
you know, Mike McGurk would come out and say, and now, weighing in at 485 pounds. Oh, come on.
McGurk? No. I always had this. I haven't gone into this enough. My idea of the Gorilla Monsoon supermarket, where like you put like a bunch of bananas on there, and it weighs like 28 pounds because Gorilla's concept of weight is completely different.
So it's only produce with the produce scale. Like it's not like, you know, you go to buy like a pound of beef and it costs you $45.
Yeah. Well, Gorilla has a separate gravity scale compared with what the actual Earth's gravity.
I like that idea. I wonder if he would be very competitive with the Amazon Fresh.
Yeah. Now they're working this match a little bit slower now, and I'm okay with that because Kurt Angle is a 50-year-old man.
Uh-oh. Channeling a little WrestleMania 2.
You're just going to Susan St. James,
James this, yes. No, go ahead.
How dare you, sir. Well, they're going a little bit slower because Angle is a 50-year-old man out there.
Yes.
And we talked about this off the recorder earlier.
Yeah.
Where I'm okay with him facing Baron Corbin and him destroying him in 2.5 minutes and just having a nice farewell, hitting all of his moves, popping the crowd, making everybody happy.
Right.
And then your idea.
Well, my theory is that, and I have to give credit to where credit is due, and that would be myself. Okay. But I thought of this myself. If I was booking WrestleMania, then God knows I should be. I think what should happen is he should be Baron Corbin. I wouldn't even give him like 2 minutes. I would say let him go in there, let him give him the angle slam, and then give him wrap him in the angle lock, and that be it. And then get on the microphone, everybody's cheering, everybody's excited, and then have him say something like, give me a real competitor, give me a real challenger, and then all of a sudden you hear, and then John Cena, if we can see him, I don't know, it might be difficult.
Well,
then,
especially if there's a blizzard, like we talked about.
I know you're going to WrestleMania, and I apologize in advance if this is what happens, but there would be nothing better than seeing all the crowd shivering because you have like all these little kids out there with their John Cena shirts and their Roman Reigns shirts and everybody's excited and it's just snow or maybe torrential downpour with like lightning storm. I just...
No. It's got to be the snow so we can have my idea for the snow plow ring cart like WrestleMania 3, but it's got a snow plow in the front of it.
If only we could gimmick WrestleMania to have that actually happen.
And then the snow plow comes down and it pours all the snow right on Brock Lesnar guy's head.
I think that would be great. I mean, we should maybe table this idea for the Rumble next year, because instead of doing it somewhere nice and warm, they should do it like Green Bay, Wisconsin. You know,
did they announce where the Royal Rumble is next year?
I think it's going to be Green Bay, Wisconsin.
Highly frozen tundra. Highly unlikely, Jess. I don't think they're having it outdoors at Lambeau Field.
I mean, I think that would be great. I mean, well, from what I understand, that field is insulated, at least underneath, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, that's okay.
Didn't they announce Houston or some such thing? It's in a big dome stadium somewhere, and it's probably a baseball field.
God, another dome stadium.
Well, you gotta have it in warm weather.
It is a big four pay-per-view.
It's hard to travel to places in January when the weather is gonna be bad. People don't want to make plans to go to, you know, Bangor, Maine. What? Not that they were gonna have... By the way, the Royal Rumble in Bangor, Maine would be so hysterical because, like, seriously, I would like rent a place up. I would rent like a cottage up there and I would host people.
I would love it if it was at the Hampton Beach Casino Ballroom. Oh.
We get the angle with the German suplexes. But I think there should be a greetings from Allentown Cottage. It's two.
He's and not releasing them.
The rule of three. He's hanging on to Samoa Joe by the way.
Oh, we got him up!
And one,
a cover. One, two.
He got him. He got him. He got him. He got him. It's all over.
That was a two count.
Oh, no, wait. No, he didn't.
That was a two count.
He didn't get him.
No, okay. I want to go back.
Oh, angle slit. I love how that got me. It drew me in right away.
Oh, this Friday.
A nice inverted atomic drop.
Saturday, West Virginia.
Let me tell you something. Kurt Angle.
This Sunday, Hershey, Pennsylvania.
Are you trying to do the Howard Finkel?
Next Monday, Washington, D.C.
The WWF on tour.
Join the WWE live on tour, Washington, D.C. Coming to you next Monday, Monday Night Raw. Wouldn't be the penultimate. This is the penultimate.
Yes.
Monday Night
there's
Raw.
One more after this. Yes. Like the way to remember it is my idea for the penultimate warrior. Angle slam! Two.
No!
And coming to the Jaffa Mosque in Altoona, Pennsylvania. Hacksaw Jim Duggan is on the docket. I said it before. I always love when they would say that the Bolsheviks were coming, as if that's going to get people off their ass into the arena.
And don't forget to join us this Saturday afternoon for a matinee show in Terre Haute, Indiana. On the card is the Bolsheviks and Dino Bravo.
So we're not doing a lot of play-by-play there. A near fall there for Samoa Joe with the power slam that I give 5 DiBiases out of 10.
Yeah.
It was like a snap power slam.
It was a little bit of a weak power slam.
You know what? I'm going to give it 6, actually.
Wow, you're being very generous today.
I give low ratings to a lot of DiBiase power slams. Like, I gave a 2 on one of the recent shows.
Well, I would say you're definitely not Dave Meltzer.
Wow. This is definitely not the Tokyo Dome. There's no Japanese restaurants within 3 miles of here.
Uh-oh, the straps are down.
The straps are down. Jerry Lawler is filing a copyright infringement suit against
him. The straps are down.
Here we go with the angle slam.
Nope. Up.
Because Samoa...
Up, headbutt. The Samoan headbutt.
Samoa Joe a little on the tubby side. But I still love him.
Well, you know what's funny is I want to get back to this. Is that the coquina clutch? I want to get back to the idea that, you know, Samoa Joe happens to be the same age as us. You know, one of the things that always upset me was that BJ Novak is the same age as us.
Yeah.
And when I used to watch The Office, I would get very angry watching The Office because I was like, you know what? I could have been that guy. I could have been BJ Novak had somebody given me a chance.
Oh, you gotta let go. You're always like, I could have been that guy. You know what I love about...
I could have been Samoa Joe.
Oh!
And a total shocker.
So he counters the Coquina Clutch with a sort of Bret Hart move, and Kurt Angle continues the Ric Flair victory tour.
Shades of WrestleMania 8.
Blows out his career. I don't like the you suck thing. Can we be nice to him for once? I don't know. I'm just saying, it would be a nice gesture.
What I want to know is, if the Patriot had stayed around, if Del Wilkes had stayed around, would we be doing You Suck to Del Wilkes?
No. You know what I think is going to happen? The Patriot is going to face Kurt Angle WrestleMania after he's done with Baron Corbin, and he's going to pull off the mask. And it's going to be Rob Gronkowski.
Oh, is it Rob Gronkowski? Yeah.
And I think that's a good way, since that match is now over. Kurt Angle victorious over Samoa Joe.
Yes.
So for Keithy, the voice of greetings from Allentown, this is Pete saying good night, everybody.